So today I want to essentially continue Mikko's talk from yesterday and provide some more information. Firstly, for the motivation, I have two parts. Part one is essentially somewhat reasoning why this new approach is to some extent necessary. So I want to critically assess the static potentials that are typically used so far in potential models and discuss a little bit what I think is possibly wrong with them, or difficult at least. And in the second part, I want to further discuss some perturbative but also non-perturbative aspects of this new real-time potential, which Mikko introduced yesterday. Okay, so the motivation Mikko has of course given is the fate of Quarkonia in the QCD plasma. And I want to quote Peter from his slide number 8. You can check it on the workshop here a couple of weeks ago. And he says, MEM is not reliable for reconstructing spectral functions at finite temperature. And this is maybe a bit a harsh statement. I don't think it's a consensus in the MEM community, but it certainly highlights the difficulties, because Peter, after all, is a practitioner himself. So it's expedient to also pursue other approaches, and if only to, even if the other approaches can't solve the problem entirely, they might be useful in providing an anchor in certain limits, for example, to tune the default models that later on should go back into these maximum entropy analyses. Okay, and here I want to discuss potential models, and in particular I want to discuss, and that's essentially the purpose of our work, the question whether or not it's possible to bridge the potential model somehow to quantum field theory. Can one reduce the amount of modeling required there? Okay, and again, as Mikko has mentioned already yesterday, the starting point, or the situation, is quite good actually at zero temperature. There you can relate the static potential in an effective field theory sense to QCD, and that happens in so-called potential non-relativistic QCD, where the static potential appears as a matching coefficient in the effective theory after integrating out the heavy quark mass scale, and the expansion parameter is the energy minus twice the heavy quark mass divided by m. Okay, and the procedure then is to solve a time-independent Schrödinger equation in a confining potential, and this confining potential very often nowadays is taken from lattice simulations. And as Mikko has pointed out, this is not entirely one-to-one, because this matching coefficient is of course defined in a perturbative procedure, but you can think of it as non-perturbative renormalization sort of going on to give you the fully non-perturbative potential here. And the results for this procedure are actually quite spectacular. You get very successful spectroscopy with about 1% accuracy. And also this is used in ongoing research for hybrids and exotic quantum numbers, etc. Okay. Now at finite temperature, the standard practice is in much worse shape. So far there was no such effective theory approach around, and people just say, okay, you somehow have to argue for a finite temperature modification of your static potential. So you somehow, on phenomenological grounds, you argue what changes as you switch on a temperature, and then you proceed as above. You simply again solve your Schrödinger equation in this somehow changed finite temperature static potential and draw your conclusions. Okay, and just to set up my notation, let me go back again to the situation at zero temperature, where we exactly know what the static potential means. So this is of course defined by the Wilson loop. So starting point is a correlation function of some meson state. So you have a quark and antiquark, and they are bound by some flux U, which is a string typically, or on the lattice it's a bunch of links. And you correlate this thing, and then of course you can integrate out the quarks in the heavy mass limit and do your weak contractions, and then this meson correlator goes over into this free propagator for the heavy quarks and a Wilson loop. So this is already in Euclidean time. And if you put this thing on the lattice, then you have typically here periodic boundary direction, boundary conditions in the time direction, and you have a compact time which parametrizes your inverse temperature. And the zero temperature limit is obtained by sending this time extent to infinity. Okay, and then the static potential appears in the spectral decomposition of this Wilson loop. So you simply write it as an vacuum expectation value, insert a complete set of eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, and what you end up with is a superposition of exponentials with matrix elements. And if you send this temporal lattice extension or your time direction to infinity, then only the lowest state survives. So in the large time limit, only the lowest state survives, and this is precisely the static potential, which gives the usual confinement linear potential. Okay, and then the generalization to finite temperature on the lattice has not been clear for a long time. And one reason is just simply practical. So first of all, we're in Euclidean time, and Euclidean time here is of course, also used to parametrize temperature. That's one thing. And the other thing is rather practical. If you have a lattice, then these n taus, the compact time dimension, is actually very small, if you're interested in temperatures around the phase transition. So it doesn't make much sense to consider a time-dependent correlator on very short lattices. I mean, this is one of the problems that actually these maximum entropy methods struggle with, so they have to go to anisotropic lattices, etc. Okay, in perturbation theory, of course, this is not a problem. You can go rather directly to finite T. Okay, back to the lattice. So what did people do to describe static potentials at finite temperatures? Well, there the name potential maybe loses its meaning, although it's used synonymously for the more appropriate term free energies. And the description here that has been used for many years is the Polyakov loop. And I don't know who first came up with this free energy interpretation. To my knowledge, it's these guys. I don't know if Polyakov himself already thought about that in those terms. I'm not sure. In any case, if you take now a Wilson line that wraps around the through the periodic boundary, so you take your static quark, let it propagate through the boundary, then the trace of this thing is a gauge invariant observable, transforms in the adjoint, and the trace, of course, kills the transformation matrices, and that thing behaves like a free energy, or better, like a free energy difference between the heat bath without a quark and the heat bath with a static quark. And of course, that's an order parameter for confinement. In the pure gauge theory, it's either zero or non-zero, depending on whether you have confinement or deconfinement. All right, then you can look at a pair of static quarks and look at the correlation function. And that is now a funny thing, because it's both a correlation function in space. You can either consider this as a spatial correlation function or as a temporal correlation function. And if you consider it in time, so you use your transfer matrix to propagate this in time, as one usually does, then this corresponds to the free energy of a static quark-antiquark pair. Okay, and now this is something you can easily simulate, and these data are not the youngest. They come from, I have a whole bunch of them, these are all from various people in Bielefeld. And this is, of course, what people then use. So as I said, they often call this a potential, this free energy, and consider this potential now temperature dependent. And what you see is essentially, so on the left, we have a number of temperatures or lattice couplings that correspond to temperatures below the deconfinement temperature. And what you see is you always get a linear potential still, and the string tension is slightly, or is diminishing as a function of temperature. And you can actually fit the string tension, the temperature dependence, by this formula, which is a string inspired that comes from some effective string model for the flux tube. And so this is the decrease of the string tension with temperature, but everywhere you still have a linear potential. And then you have a sudden drastic change if you go across the deconfinement temperature, and you get this screened potential, and it's clearly exponentially screened, and you can fitted, for example, by such a formula, you now have a screening mass appearing here in the exponent. Okay, and then you can also ask yourself, this was also a question yesterday, what happens if you now, in reality, of course, you have dynamical quarks in the plasma, light quarks. So you can do that also on the lattice. So the static quarks are now supposed to describe charm or bottom or whatever. But you can also switch on some light dynamical degrees of freedom. And then the situation changes somewhat. So now, even at temperatures below TC, you have, of course, screening of the color force. In that case, it's responsible for that are, of course, light fundamental charges. So you get string breaking even below TC. And you can see, but you can still see you have sort of a linear range. What is plotted here, this solid line is the Cornell potential, or a Cornell potential fit to the zero temperature data. And so you can see that with increasing temperature, your string breaking sets in earlier and earlier. And again, once you're above TC, you have a fully screened, exponentially screened potential.
One over R, because here you have an averaging of two states of quarks, singlet and triplet.
I'll get to that.
And then the dominant, the leading behavior is 1 over R squared.
I'll get to that. So I'll get to that. This in any case is the zero temperature, is simply the zero temperature potential. And so this is the thermal thing, and what you find is that at short distance it always matches onto the zero temperature potential, and that's actually how it should be. And I can say right away what you say is what one naively thinks, but it's I'll show you it's wrong. All these potentials are superpositions of the excited states of the same zero T static potential. I'll show you in a bit. Okay, so now let's look at the screening a little bit more, and this is already making contact with Stanislav's question. So at above TC, we would now like to know what is this screening mass that is responsible for the screening of the confining force, and that is, of course, the fundamental theory of model of deconfinement that is supposed to be caused by Debye screening. Okay, so here is again this is the fit for these screened static potentials for this mass parameter mu of t in units of mass. And you can see that above a certain temperature you have some constant here, so there is a only slightly t-dependent screening mass divided by t. So the remaining t dependence is, of course, in the coupling constant. And what you find numerically is that this power here is close to 1.5. And what you find for the screening mass is a bit surprising. This screening mass is not the Debye mass, but it's rather actually the lightest gauge invariant excitation that you have, or the lightest gauge invariant blue ball excitation in three dimensions. I mean, this is a spatial screening that's going on. So your agents that are doing this are the 3D mass states, essentially. Okay, and you can compare this with, for example, a direct measurement of this blue ball screening mass, and you find the two agree. Now, you can understand this actually in perturbation theory. If you do perturbation theory of this quantity, you also don't get the Debye mass, but you get twice the Debye screening mass, because you're correlating trace of a Wilson line with trace of the Wilson line, and tracing the Wilson line means the leading term is a two-glue exchange, okay? So you get twice the Debye mass. So in other words, we conclude that this free energy of a static quark antiquark pair does not correspond to the Debye screen static potential. So this is the first candidate which you might consider sticking into your Schrödinger equation in a potential model, and that would suggest it's probably not a good idea, because this is not giving you the Yukawa potential with just one debye mass up there. Okay, so now let me come in some detail to Stanislav's comment. What to do now? Well, people realize that you have a fundamental and an anti-fundamental source, and then just on color group theory, of course, you can combine them in different. They can combine to either a singlet or an octet. Okay, and this F Q bar Q, which I have just considered, in which you take the trace of these two guys separately, this can be decomposed in a singlet channel and in an octet channel, and that's what Stanislav just said. So this thing, therefore, is called an average potential or free energy, because it simply averages with an appropriate Clebsch weight over the two channels. Okay, now the singlet channel, that would be defined now as the trace. So you first correlate these guys and then take the trace. And the octet is then the appropriate linear superposition. And the problem, of course, with this is, if you want to consider this in a lattice simulation, is that this correlation function is no longer gauge independent. Okay, if you have you have now different transformation matrices at x and y, and they don't cancel under the trace. Now, in perturbation theory, of course, you can do a calculation, fix a gauge, do your leading order calculation, and this indeed proceeds by one gluon exchange. So this gives you the debye screen Yukawa potential you had in mind from the beginning, and the question is, what happens non-perturbatively?
So aren't you going to get something different if you choose a different gauge?
Yes, I'll show you how that works. So if you have big machines sitting around, then of course it's always tempting to just do an experiment. So here is a simulation of these three channels separately, and so here are these three channels. The middle one is always this average potential. The lowest one is the singlet potential, and the upper one is this octet or adjoint channel. And this upper bunch of curves is in this is below TC slightly, and this is slightly above TC. And this is dynamical, so you also get so there are light quarks in the game as well, so you get this screening in any case. And again, this is the zero temperature potential, and you see that both of these, the singlet and the average at zero distance, they more or less approach this. I mean, you have one fixing or normalization to do here, but the functional behavior is roughly the same. Nevertheless, there is a difference now. Okay, and now I have a choice to make. In which potential do I calculate my bound state, or which potential do I use for my quarkonium application at finite temperature? And as I was saying, because of this debye screening, issue with twice the quark mass of the average potential, people have then decided to take this singlet channel. And not only that, they also, as Miko indicated yesterday, at some point people argued, well, the free energy contains an entropy contribution. Maybe we should take as a potential the expectation value of the Hamiltonian, say, the potential part, and that would be the internal energy. So you would subtract or add rather the entropy contribution. In any case, it's clear if you look at these curves that, of course, you get different binding behavior, right? This singlet potential is lower and steeper, so it will bind longer than this average potential, and you will get, of course, different binding energies and different conclusions for this quarkonium melting.
So this is from lattice simulations in Coulomb gauge.
This is lattice simulations in Coulomb gauge.
There's no issue of Grebov copies.
Of course there is. Yeah. So there are issues of Grebov copies, but even without those, I think there, as I'll explain now, I think this is a dangerous thing to do. So you have different R dependence here, and the question is, Grebov copies or not, but suppose the gauge fixing works perfectly, the question is this R dependence, this difference in the R dependence, is that physics, or is it having to do with gauging, with the Coulomb gauge? So your question, does it change if you take a different gauge?
Will you give numbers for this closed
loop?
Close the correlator on top of the
Yes, yes.
Will you give numbers?
Well, I don't know what you mean by numbers. For the correlator, or I'll show pictures, yes. Why is this not? Oops. Ah. Maybe I ran out of of battery. Excuse me. Okay. So let me try to improve on this gauge fixing question. That's something that I did with Oliver Jahn a couple of years ago. So trying to get rid of the need for gauge fixing, we instead of simply decomposing this Polyakov loop correlator, we sort of start over again, as one does for the Wilson loop, by looking at meson operators. So here is, of course, the usual singlet meson that you have. And now we constructed an operator that would correspond to a meson that carries a color charge. So we introduce somewhere along the string that connects the two quarks, you insert a generator matrix, and that gives it a color charge. And that's actually nowadays an interesting object because, as you know, Shuryak and Zahed, for example, they have this proposal that in the deconfined phase it might be all bound states, but they carry color, etc. So this would be an operator by which you could describe such things. Okay, now I can construct my singlet and my octet channel separately by correlating these two kinds of operators, and again then integrating out the static quarks, doing my weak contractions, and then what I get is I have these polyakov, and I, of course I do the correlator. It stretches along the whole lattice. But now what you do is, in this weak contraction, you're left with strings between where the charges were sitting. And the result is that in this singlet channel, you now get what's called the periodic Wilson loop. You have your temporal Wilson lines, and they are connected by spatial Wilson lines at the boundaries of the lattice. And then, of course, the octet channel is just a superposition of this new singlet operator and the average operator. Okay, now this thing, this object is of course gauge invariant, so no problems. But it has, if you like, an operator dependence. You could of course choose a wiggly line here or have some detours, so you have an operator dependence that's the same as in a meson operator. And also, but you can see that this is, again, the thing that you want. If you now fix this gauge invariant, I can fix any gauge I want. So if I go to axial gauge, in which these spatial Wilson lines are one, then this is precisely this object that McLaren and Swietycki had in mind. So then these gauge fixed correlators are identical to these ones, but only in axial gauge, in no other gauge. Okay. So now we have an object, and we can do a spectral analysis again. So we are inserting our transfer matrix, and it acts in a Hilbert space with sources. That's the transfer matrix in temporal gauge. So it's a Kogat-Suskind Hamiltonian that's sitting in the exponent, and that propagates these states in time. And what happens is you cannot fix temporal gauge everywhere on the lattice. So if you have compact time dimension, then on the last link, as you go through the boundary, that link you cannot gauge fix, otherwise you would have a loop fixed to one. That's not allowed. So instead, these open links, they correspond to a projection operator, and what that does is it ensures to you that you're projecting on the right Hilbert space with a source and an anti-source at some point. And then you can do that calculation, insert your complete set. And what you see is the eigenstates, of course, have indices now, corresponding to the fundamental sources at the two points in time, and then you get here your energy eigenlevels, and these energy eigenlevels are precisely the static potential. That's the lowest one. It's identically the same as the zero t potential, and then for the higher ends, it's simply the radial excitations. Okay, and what you can see is that these things are, of course, normalized, and so to one, essentially, and this is really a free energy. This is just an exponential sum or a Boltzmann weight with energy eigenvalues. But now if you look at these singlet and octet channels, then you see that things are not so easy. And the reason is that now if you insert your set of eigenstates and pull, so you have a U here and a U here, we still have these strings around, and if you pull them through the projection operator, then you get a shuffle of indices, and now these spatial string indices, they get contracted with those of the eigenstates that contribute to the sum. And so here you have a non-vanishing matrix element, okay? And as I was saying, this is equivalent to these gauge fixed things in a fixed gauge. So if you were gauge fixing, instead of the U's here, you would have some gauge fixing functions that would sit in there, by which you fix your Polyakov loop to whatever you want. So in other words, these energy eigenvalues here are everywhere the same in all three channels. But there are non-vanishing matrix elements in the singlet and in the octet channels, and these matrix elements depend on what's going on in the gauge fixing function or on the string between them.
So it also depends on your choice.
Yes. So in other words, coming back, yeah, let me demonstrate this, and this is the numbers for KO. Though this is in a toy model at the moment, but this issue is of course independent of the group. You can do that for SUN. So I did it for SU2 in 3D, and the reason is in order to cleanly isolate the lowest energies and the matrix elements, I want to make the time direction very long, and then of course the signal gets exponentially suppressed. So I chose a very cheap theory to get more statistics, and. If you remember the plot about the three channels of these three energies, the difference was biggest at the smallest distances. So here I show you the correlators at the smallest lattice distance in these three channels. And you can see they all, of course, have different values. But the exponential decay is absolutely and identically the same as I told you from the spectral analysis. And of course, the spectral analysis is exact. I mean, there is no approximation. And then you can look at the matrix element of the ground state. And the matrix element in the average channel, you can see, is constant. It's R independent. And that's, in fact, just 1 over n squared is 1/4 in SU2. So that's as it should be. So this really is a free energy. But these other two guys, they have matrix elements which have a non-trivial R dependence. Okay. And now if I fix Coulomb gauge, I get one R dependence. If I fix another gauge, I get another R dependence.
How about changing now your path to connect?
Same story. And of course, at zero temperature, this doesn't matter. You have, in fact, the same. Of course, you have the same thing happening in the Wilson loop, for example. But you're only interested in the energy level, the potential at zero temperature. So you throw out the matrix elements. At finite temperature, the problem is you want really the superposition of the population of the different energy levels. Now you have to somehow know what these matrix elements mean. Are they well defined or not? Okay, and the problem, or one problem with this has to do with what Mikko discussed yesterday in this, if you take this periodic Wilson loop, in the end, what you want is a current-current correlator. So in this potential, you want to take the R to zero limit. Okay, and this question disappears. It does not disappear if you take gauge-fixed correlators, because gauge fixing is always non-local in space. So even if you take the R to zero limit, you sample, you know, all points in space in different ways, in different gauges. So coming back to this difference between different gauge-fixed channels, of these free energies or potentials, the conclusion is that the difference between this average channel and the singlet channel, this difference is entirely and exclusively in the matrix elements. Okay, all the gauge invariant energy eigenvalues entering these two curves are identically the same at all levels. So it's beyond me to understand how you can extract physical meaning from this. I don't know. At least you have to say why one gauge is better than another. Okay, so let's come to part two. I hope I have convinced you that there is a certain confusion about which potential to use, and also free energy or internal energy. That's another thing. So that's why we made the attempt to try to get a bit closer to an effective field theory approach. And as Mikko has explained, it's quite complicated because you now have additional scales that come from the thermal theory, and you have to see how these different scales behave relative to each other. So this, just to remind you of yesterday's starting point, was a finite temperature and Minkowski time correlator that is related to the Kwaikonium spectral function. And what we look at is a Schrödinger equation, type equation, evolution equation of this correlator, which you obtain in a sort of a 1 over m expansion. And this real-time static potential is defined to be the coefficient in this equation that scales like order 1 in this m expansion.
But again, you see bigger depends on the path you choose for your gauge invariant two-point function. And your potential, V bigger, will also then be choice-dependent.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't really solve these issues which you just raised. Right?
No, it does, because you can, not at the intermediate step, but this whole point splitting is an intermediate step to make the thing
R to zero.
Exactly. And that's what Mikko explicitly did yesterday in producing these spectral functions. He always took the R to zero limit of the correlator. So, and then this U goes strictly away. Okay. So, you should get the same result for the limit, starting from different choices. Okay, so what I'll be concerned with is, of course, only the static limit, where this correlation function that Mikko introduced yesterday reduces to, again, this trivial phase factor, and then it's a Wilson loop, except now, of course, what we want is a Wilson loop in Minkowski time. So you can obtain that from the Euclidean Wilson loop, the standard Wilson loop, then analytically continued. Okay, and the Schrödinger equation that governs its evolution is given here. This is sort of the master equation which we now like to solve. And Mikko has shown you already the perturbative solution yesterday. The relevant object here, or what we need to do to be self-consistent, is we need to consider the large time limit of this static potential, and that's simply a consequence that we are having a non-relativistic expansion. So our energy levels that we consider the binding energies, if you like, are always smaller than the momenta, and that means that T should be large compared to R.
Doesn't matter. I mean, the B doesn't.
Dimensional inconsistent.
B only appears on the right hand side. W appears on the left.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Yeah. Okay. So this was the result that Mikko showed yesterday. The real part is, of course, the device screening that is familiar, and then there was this additional imaginary part that he interpreted it as being due to Landau damping. Okay, and what I want to discuss now is what about non-perturbative effects? Can we somehow get a handle on non-perturbative effects? Now, that's not so easy. Of course, I'm kind of back to square one. If I would know to calculate this Wilson loop in Minkowski time completely non-perturbatively, I wouldn't need a potential. So obviously that's not possible. But now you can think about maybe solving part of the problem or making progress on part of it, considering the scales in the problem. So we have vertices that go as g squared t. We have a cutoff, and we have this three-dimensional confinement scale g squared t, which enters in the propagator, sort of serving as an infrared cutoff to the Linde problem. And that is, of course, the thing that then makes things difficult in perturbation theory. So,
yeah? In principle, suppose you could do Minkowski time calculations, then you could just take a Wilson loop and calculate large time, not Euclidean time, but real time.
Yes.
It would be same physics, right?
If you could do the whole thing, yes.
Doesn't matter that it suddenly becomes oscillating in terms of, instead of exponentially decaying.
for the the lowest oscillation frequency, and that again gives you.
You'll see a cartoon of that result in a bit. Okay, so these corrections to this approach, or to the leading order, if you like, come into, there are two kinds. One is sort of in the derivation of the effective theory in the first place. So the perturbative result that Mikko presented was half-film loop resummation in leading order. And if you look at corrections to that, the expansion parameter is chi squared t divided by the UV cutoff lambda. So that is a perturbative correction, which, if you work hard, you can in principle calculate. But there is a parameter, and if you're lucky enough, the corrections are decent or small. But there is a bigger problem, and that's of course what is this infrared problem here from the 3D confinement scale, and that also Mikko showed yesterday. Your expansion parameter is chi squared t divided by that infrared scale, and then your chi squared is gone. So this is entirely non-perturbative. And what one can do now, that's another part of the project, is you can test for these corrections, these non-perturbative corrections, by classical lattice simulations in the spirit that was also applied, for example, to the sphalerone rate calculations in electroweak theory, or to plasma instabilities. Essentially, this long-range thermal physics is dominated by modes that have a high occupation number, and these behave to a good approximation classically. Okay, in order to know what to expect, let's first have a look at the classical limit in perturbation theory. So taking this expression for this this perturbative expression for this real-time static potential, we can reintroduce the factors of h bar in the calculation. So the vertices pick up a factor of h bar, and the temperature picks up a factor of 1 over h bar. And then if you do that in this formula, sort of naively, you see that only the imaginary part survives the classic limit. So this real part vanishes if you take the classic limit. So it's clear we cannot get the full answer. What we can do is a classical simulation of this Landau damping effects. Nevertheless, that will serve as an important test. This imaginary part is new, and you would like to know if it's genuinely non-perturbative as well. So a classical lattice simulation is essentially a Hamiltonian approach. So what happens is you leave time continuous and discretize only the spatial box, so you have a 3D lattice. And then you have your field variables, which are the links. And then you have conjugate fields, which are the electric fields, which basically drive the time translation of the gauge variables. And because you want to, well, in order to define conjugate fields, you need to fix a gauge again, which is again the temporal gauge. And then you have a Gauss constraint that repairs that. That ensures that you're in your correct gauge invariant sector. Okay, so here is the partition function that we have, that basically gives us our thermal example. We have the Kogat-Susskind Hamiltonian supplemented by the Gauss constraint, and this gives you your partition function of the system, and the lattice, this beta here is now a lattice beta, which is combination of the 3D effective coupling and the lattice spacing. Okay, and then the time evolution of this of the fields is simply governed by the classical equations of motion, the classical field equations. Now, it's well known that if you do a purely classical field theory, you run into the genes problem in the ultraviolet. And but this problem can be treated, and this was in particular done in context with the sphalerone rate by these guys. And the way to do it is that you take, again, an effective theory. So, for example, our half-thermal loop theory, that is an effective theory for the infrared modes, which you obtained by integrating out the hard modes. And the hard modes, they have already, they incorporate, they know about the UV cutoff, so they give you the right UV behavior. And now you have to somehow couple this to the soft modes, and you can do that by introducing particles, these are fictitious particles that you introduce, similar to ghost fields, to obtain this right UV behavior. And you can also that will also localize your effective action. So you then add to your Hamiltonian a piece, which introduces these auxiliary fields, and you integrate essentially over all directions of these fictitious particles in which they travel in the plasma. And the parameter that governs that comes from integrating out your Hartmanns, and that's in fact the biomass. Okay, then there are some technical issues. You now have to discretize these fields. You can do that in a number of ways, and we have compared that they actually are the same. And your field equations are modified, so now you have a current which is represented by these fictitious particles, and of course you get an extra equation for the evolution of this particle distribution. So your set of equation gets enlarged, but this thing...
What equation do you use then?
For this thing. It's definite. I just haven't written it down because it's a bit lengthy. I mean, it's on the right. You have these W's, and you have electric fields from the. So it's just the coupling from between the gauge fields and these W fields. Okay, and then you can simulate this. And the way to do it is, how do you thermalize the system? First, you get your three-dimensional gauge fields. You can take a shortcut and take those from a Monte Carlo, draw those from a Monte Carlo simulation of the 3D effective theory. So that will give you a pre-thermalized 3D U configuration, which is not, of course, coupled to anything. So it's not the right, it's not equilibrated, but it's close. Then you draw electric fields from a Gaussian distribution. And then in the third step, you project onto the subspace that satisfies the Gauss law. So you take only those parts of the E field and the U field that really now correspond to a correct physical configuration. And then you let this configuration evolve using the equation of motion. So that mixes the E's and the U's up until they are thermalized.
What defines the magnitude of the electric field width of your Gaussian?
In principle, I mean, you can, of course, rescale this by rescaling time, for example, or something. But in principle, that's fixed. I mean, you have it's the conjugate field to the links. So once you have fixed your action and your conventions at one point, that's given. Right, and then when things are thermalized, so you have to monitor, for example, the energy or something to see if you're stable. And once that is the case, you can switch on measurements of any observable that you want. And this is now the important thing again. So this whole field evolution is in temporal gauge. but what we look at is a gauge invariant variable, namely a Wilson loop. This would now be in Minkowski time. And in temporal gauge, of course, the time-like links are one. But the thing is gauge invariant. So here it's simply a correlation function of this spatial string with the spatial string at a later time. And here is the numerical result. And this is what you expected. You just have your wiggles in the beginning, which then die out. And you see a decay both with time as well as with R, which is what you expect. And here is, of course, the real time wiggles. Okay, and now you can compare this. That was the purpose of the exercise, to compare this with perturbation theory. So what I showed you was the correlation function. You can now extract the classical potential from this correlation function. And it's purely imaginary, as you expect from perturbation theory. And what is shown here on the left is the simulation result. And what is shown here on the right is the analytic calculation, just adapted to a lattice cutoff. So you can do this Hartmann loop calculation and put it on a lattice and do the perturbation theory calculation there. And you see a rather striking agreement between the two. It's certainly semi-quantitative. There are certain differences. What you can, what you find if you go in particular to longer times and longer R is that the non-perturbative results have a larger magnitude of this imaginary part that seems to remain there. So this is the most interesting piece of information. If you go here asymptotically to long times, you always have a non-zero imaginary part. So perturbation theory gave you the right answer.
And lambda damping appears if you, you can emit quanta on, from it. It's associated with the behavior of the dispersion relation. That you can do it on, you know, one particle can emit something and still stay on the dispersion relation. What is particular? What are the particular changes in the dispersion relation with temperature that allow for this to happen? Lambda damping is simply an experiment, right?
And the gluons which are lambda damped, they are not on shell. You cannot think of them as lambda damping takes place when the gluon frequency is less than its momentum. They are off shell. And this fact is independent of, I mean, it's, you know.
But then you're not on the dispersion relation.
We're not on the non shell phenomenon. It's a field which is damped by on shell particles.
So then you get it from the perturbation theory with all the observations.
Yeah. Also, it happens on the lattice. In the lattice, your hard particles.
On shell, then you have to connect it to the next, which something which bring takes it off shell, and this gives extra coupling cost. So if you stay in the lowest possible order of the coupling cost, and you don't have the off shell built.
No. You have. I mean, your fields are, and the coupling comes from the interaction with the hard particles.
But the there is no coupling. Your formula is
no coupling. No, there is coupling here. It's an non-abelian theorem.
Here you have all couplings, but you're saying it agrees with the perturbation theory, and there you have just the lowest order.
No,
but you have couplings. It's a Wilson loop which exchanges. You have glue lines exchanged in the middle. There is coupling.
And you said it also works for QED.
Works for QED. In QED, you have that. So here, if you would do this for abelian, you wouldn't see anything. You know, this is just pure gauge fields. But in QED, you have fermions, and that's
right.
So in QED, it's essential to have fermions. In an abelian theory, you can do it also with pure group if you want, because the interactions are already there.
Okay.
Yesterday, we were told the perturbation theory converges slowly. But now you show it working very well. This is the imaginary part.
I mean the question is what you want in terms of accuracy. So here we have a, you know, depending on how large you make ROT, you find say a 50% quantitative accuracy. So it's not, you know, it's not terribly accurate. But of course, it would now be very interesting to see what this thing does with the next correction. But it seems certainly to be going rather well, actually. One wouldn't have necessarily expected this one.
You don't have to recover the classical statistical result. The classical statistical result is the exact result under the assumption that there is no quantum correction. So you don't even know it's 50%. It's just indicative. Yeah, I mean, if you don't want to hit this left curve.
No.
Contribution from quantum corrections that could bring the.
But there are the quantum corrections come sort of in two different parts. They come first from sort of creating the effective theory, but these are both computed from the same starting point. So you're really checking only for the infrared corrections that are within the effective theory. So.
I mean, the reason for the slow convergence are the infrared effects.
Yeah.
And these you can check here.
And you say it's purely classical then?
Yeah, in this case it's purely classical. Well, there is some, if there's some subtle effect whereby there are some other, I mean, you get effects from the cutoff scale, but they are very, in this case they're also very, so they're very small. So the dominant effects come only from the classical, from the infrared modes, and this you can check here with this. you don't check, of course, you don't check genuine hard effects. You don't check running of the coupling or so. I mean, it's much sure not. But that's, in any case, not the problem like for those slow conversions.
Okay, so.
This imaginary part, and when you put it there to two-body problem. Imaginary part means that something disappears from the channel from the start. And then the question is, what is this other channel to which you go? And as an example, say you have a medium and you say, and you put a particle that runs through it, you calculate it has an imaginary potential because it's an exponent. Okay. Then you put an atom, let's say, which is a composite object, and if you were to put this, imaginary potential for each of the constituents of the atom, you would say, it's imaginary, so it should be breaking, okay? But the atom can be stable and go through the medium and the mid things and do all kinds of stuff, but remains an atom.
I think the way you should think of it is like with plasmon oscillations.
Okay.
So you have some kind of a collective effect, mm-hmm. oscillation,
yes.
and that dance, that's kind of an imaginary part.
Yes.
But the information doesn't disappear anywhere because
dance,
you have
this
whole
once we mean that your Charmonium, for example, slows down.
Yeah, but you see, you always think of charmonium as a particle. That's
not
this picture.
But it's legitimate. Let's say
case, the charmonium doesn't slow down. It's just it's in rest in any case. But it just, if you would, the quarks are not bound together anymore. They can be kicked away with the thermal fluctuation.
But
You're just redistributing spectral weight. You're just spreading spectral weight.
Okay.
I mean, it's a many particle system, and it has, and you can define a correlation with particular quantum numbers, and that has spectral weight at a particular position. And then what happens is you spread it. It's like a wave with friction, more like.
Imaginary potentials are very dangerous.
Yeah, but I mean, it's for instance, this potential is not. If you are very precise, it's a long story we can discuss, but I mean, so there is, for instance, it's the imaginary part of this potential. The sign of the imaginary part depends on whether your time is positive or negative.
Okay.
In such a way that everything is under control, nothing really is, you don't break any symmetries or anything. It's just what always happens at finite temperature, that everything, every collective oscillation.
The Schrodinger equation that had this V in it was claimed to be sort of an exact effective field theory result. It's not a Hanzon, it's something you can derive in a systematic way.
At least that's the goal. I think at this order, one can take a couple of shortcuts, but at the end of the day, this is a generalization of this PNR QCD that gives theory to finite temperatures.
Yeah, I'm more or less. At the end, I mean, we can, of course, continue discussing afterwards. So the finish simply, of course, now the problem with this classical simulation is it can't access this real part, which is, of course, important for the, not the damping, but sort of the opposite, the binding feature. And so how can we test that? And here, actually, this turns out to be difficult. I mean, if you want to get this, again, you need this Debye-screened potential, or whatever in perturbation theory corresponds to this Debye-screened potential. So really, again, what you want is somehow this type of Wilson loop analytically continues to real time. And now the question is how best to do this. You can do two things, and what we are doing at present is again a check of the analytic calculation by extending this, take this periodic Wilson loop, which you can also do. It's just a special case. You can do this in perturbation theory and then compare this to the lattice. That's one thing. Another thing, and that is unsolved, and I don't know if anybody has any ideas. Of course, what you don't need the full time dependence of this. That's the point of this potential approach, is that you don't need that. Otherwise, you're back to the full problem. What we need is the infinite time limit of this thing. But I haven't so far been able to cook up a lattice operator that would correspond to this object. So this is the difficult part to think about in the future. Okay, let me just briefly conclude. I think that the input that goes into potential models for finite quarkonium applications from a field theoretical point of view is questionable, certainly not satisfactory, because you have gauge dependence questions. You're not sure what the object really means that you're sticking in there, and there's a choice to make. There's a variety and you have to pick one, and then somehow if you're then matching it to the lattice simulation, you're not really checking the lattice simulation of the correlator that in these maximum entropy calculations. Okay, so the goal was to reformulate this in terms of effective field theories. We have this real-time static potential. And solution is possible in HTL with some perturbation theory. And as Mikko presented yesterday, you essentially get all the qualitative physics out of that. Whether it's quantitative is a different question, but you have the effects that you see. And the striking piece is this Landau damping, or the imaginary part of the potential. And that we have checked in a classical field theory calculation on the lattice, and that seems to be confirmed. So, thank you.
Just, you look always at the